Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Riley, Judge Gaidis, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this July 14 panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The proceeding today is occurring by the Zoom platform online. The parties are not present in the courtroom. But we are keeping an audio recording of the presentation, so I will remind counsel to state your name as you commence each leg of your argument for the benefit of the audio recording. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to relators counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Just be aware that if there are any glitches in technology, to just flag us and we will make sure that the technology catches up, and make sure your phone is off. And that's mine, that's on. So counsel for appellant, whenever you're, or for relator, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you, if it pleases the court, counsel. The question for the court here is, does the medical school have the ability to change an informal agreement that the university bound themselves to upon review of the circumstances and apply a significant remedy that is improper? Here, what happened is the university investigated, they made a decision
Can I just jump in? I'm sorry to interrupt you so soon in your argument, but is that really our question? Don't we have a preliminary question of whether this matter is ripe for our review for a failure to... My concern, it's been raised in the respondent's brief, is that there's been a challenge to failure not to pursue and exhaust all administrative remedies. And even though your brief sort of acknowledges that in a statement of the standard of review, I didn't actually see any argument in your brief to argue that, in fact, there's a reason for us not to apply that doctrine here. And I didn't see a reply brief. And correct me if I'm wrong, maybe there is a reply brief filed in which your client responded to that argument. But if so, I didn't see it. So can you just let me know whether there was a reply brief?
There was not a reply brief, Your Honor. The exhaustion administrative remedy is futile in this case because the way the process was done at that point,
let me stop you there just as a matter of procedure.
Yes.
If you didn't present the argument in your brief and respond and reply to the argument, or even in anticipation of the argument, why would we consider the argument now if it's just you're just making it during the oral presentation?
I was in the initial brief regarding exhausting the administrative remedies and why that should not bar the realtor from pursuing this request of the court.
What I saw in your brief, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I could be mistaken, but what I saw in your brief is somewhere, I think it was in the standard of review, you mentioned why your client didn't pursue administrative remedies, but you never made the argument in your argument section that in fact it would have been futile, that there was I think the argument is that there was bias in the decision maker, so therefore there's no reason. I didn't see that argument developed in your brief, and I don't want to take up all your time quibbling over it, but I was a little troubled by that.
Understood, Your Honor.
As a follow-up to Judge Ross's questions, you argue that it's futile, but you fail to point to anything in the record from my reading of your brief that the university was biased, and you don't cite any legal authority for the proposition that a perception of bias is sufficient to show that your failure to exhaust the appeal remedies or your appeal rights at the university level would have been futile. So what do you point to?
It's just the fundamental fairness of somebody who engages in a resolution according to policies, and the policies indicate that there's ambiguity, that the university's policy should control. And then they walk over into the medical school's review. And then upon review, the complainant then entirely doesn't withdraw and start back the formal process that
well, this is,
policy is this, designs.
This is your substantive argument about due process. But to Judge Riley's question, what is there in the record that would support the idea that you couldn't have made this very argument that you're making right now to the university during the appellate procedure? Why would we conclude that it would have been futile for your client to have made that argument to the university?
The coercive nature of being reviewed by the medical school and then being advised that withdrawing is a way to protect and mitigate the result under those circumstances create a course of nature that doesn't allow the realtor in this case to pursue that with clear judgment without pressure that's overly undue and inappropriate.
I don't understand what you mean. What do you mean by it creates a course of nature that? Are you saying that I don't understand what you're saying? How do we know from this record that the university wouldn't have said what you're asking us to say on the merits, which is, oh my goodness, let's give him another shot at this. Let's not have a double process or whatever the due process argument is that you're making. What is there in the record that would convince us that it would have been futile for your client to have made that argument?
The fact that the complainant was allowed to completely negate the agreement and explain that the university coerced her and forced her into this agreement demonstrates that the process is broken. And so at that point...
Let me ask another question, get at it another way maybe. So OSC looked at sexual harassment. That was their focus. My understanding of the med school's focus, SSC's, was it's the standard of professionalism that doctors who graduate from the University of Minnesota Med School are expected to maintain. And I don't see a conflict between those two policies. Are you arguing that there's some sort of conflict?
The conflict that I'm describing relies into the university's policies on the way they processed everything and proceeded, and then the way the medical school then grabs the result and then processes it, stripping away those protections. So you agree, you bind yourself to an agreement, and then you walk in, and then it's stripped away, and you don't have those protections anymore. And it's kind of implied.
Let me ask you this. What kind of hearings do you think your client had at both levels? Did he have formal or informal hearings?
He was afforded a formal hearing, but then had an informal resolution that removed the hearing, and then was given a formal hearing by the medical school, which then, by making that agreement, removed all of the procedural protections and the ability for the realtor to present his case, because at that point, he didn't believe he had to. He believed he had an agreement and they were going to define the terms of the...
But his emails that you submitted as part of your addendum belie that argument, because my reading of those emails is that the med school people were saying, you realize that dismissal is a possibility here.
And that was prior to engaging in the informal agreement. So he acknowledges the possibility for dismissal. The informal agreement is then engaged. And then there's discussion about how to implement that formal agreement through the faculty and the individuals that, you know, shape his academic career.
I'll have to take a closer look at the chronology of those emails, because I thought that he was told after the agreement that he reached and before his med school hearing, that dismissal was still on the table. And in any event, he withdrew. So what do we do with that? And I'm not sure what remedy you're seeking. Well, does he want to be readmitted to the med school? Is that what he's seeking?
Yes, Your Honor, under the terms of the informal agreement, and he didn't receive notice from the medical school until after the informal agreement. The formal notice wasn't received while he was informed by faculty members that dismissal was a possibility, and then engaged in this informal resolution with an advisor that is from the university that has no experience or knowledge about the medical school's disciplinary process. As he consults the people of the medical school, they seem unaware of the specific terms and need to consult with counsel and continue to ask questions in order to get finality on how the process moves forward.
Your contention is one of procedural due process, not substantive due process. Why wouldn't the remedy, even if we ruled in your favor, simply be to return it so that your client can have the hearing that he was allegedly denied, the fair hearing? Why would we order a reinstatement?
When he binds himself to that informal agreement, he's already agreed to surrender some of those procedural protections for the result. And so giving it back to the school and saying, okay, here's your opportunity to have this hearing.
So you're asking us to say as a matter of law that there's some procedural rule, I suppose it'd be some kind of a double jeopardy rule or contract rule, I don't know, that says you can't do more than what he agreed to in the second proceeding. Then what's the basis for that? What's the legal basis for us to jump into the university and say, no, once you made this arrangement with them, the second proceeding can't be any further?
It's because the medical school allowed the university to do the investigation and the disciplinary process by themselves and did not decide to do it until afterwards.
No, they have the ability. I'm asking you not the rationale for the legal conclusion that you're asking us to reach. I'm asking you for the authority, the legal authority that would support your view. What is there a case or some statute that would say that there's this binding effect of this agreement that you're asking us to impose on the university?
The case would say that the school is required to follow their own policies, and they did not in this case because of the ambiguity. They're supposed to.
I'm asking you for the legal authority, the case law, the statute that would support the proposition that you're making for the remedy that you're asking us to impose on the university. As opposed to, I mean, it seems to me if you're asking for a procedural if you're making a procedural due process challenge, we would send it back for the process that was due, not for some substantive remedy imposing a rule of law. Unless you can tell us what the authority is for that remedy.
There's not a case that fits into these facts, but the law outlines that the administrative agency should and must follow their own policies. And in this case, it's clear that they did not by the way that they processed the action.
And what specific policy, if we agreed with that theory, what specific policy can you quote for us in the university that would demonstrate that they were not, that the university, that the medical school was not allowed to proceed as it did?
I'm just looking through the record on my notes. Specifically, the respondent cites in their brief to the policy that specifically outlines that I don't have the direct cite, but that if there's ambiguity, we must rely on the university's policies. That's from the Board of Regents, And while that they're allowed to make additional policies and pursue additional sanctions, they must follow the process. And
so what process didn't they follow?
So they followed the process the first time, and then when they set for additional review, they did not follow the process. And so they must follow the process.
And which process? I'm asking for specifics.
They did not follow the informal resolution process that's outlined in their policy.
Let me put a finer point on Judge Riley's question. What specifically must the medical school have done to have fulfilled the policy that you assert was violated?
When the complainant decided to not agree with the informal process, she then should have withdrew from that. And she did not do that, and instead went to the medical school to seek the remedy, which outlines that the complainant has the ability to make that withdrawal, and then the formal process starts over again. And I see my time is up.
Your time has expired. If during the, obviously I don't want you to miss out on listening to your opponent's argument, but if you're able to multitask, it would be helpful during the next few minutes if you could maybe find the specific provisions of the policies that you say are violated and the remedy that you say the policy requires. We'd appreciate that, I'm sure. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, Dan Herber, for the purposes of the record, is my name, a senior associate general counsel at the university. The university asked the court to discharge the writ for two reasons, for failure to exhaust remedies and for failure to show a procedural due process violation. As to failure to exhaust remedies, the record reflects that on August 5th, the Scholastic Standing Committee made its decision. Relator did not like that decision, but Relator's options at that time were to pursue the appellate process, the internal appellate process within the university's Scholastic Standing Committee policy, which would allow Relator to have both sought reconsideration of the panel decision, which was a unanimous decision, but also to appeal directly to the provost's office.
Now, I understand the challenge, and I'm sure Relator's counsel will correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the challenge isn't necessarily to the first proceeding about which he received notice on August 5th, but about this the follow-up proceeding from the medical school. Am I correct as to timing that it was the university provided notice on August 5th, and then later there was the hearing and decision by the medical school?
The medical school decision, Your Honor, was on August 5th, 2020. Prior to that time, there was this informal resolution that Relator mentioned in today in court and in the brief. That process resolved on July 8th when Relator agreed to the informal resolution. As part of that agreement, Relator waived rights to seek a formal hearing. How that process had come about before that was a proposed informal resolution was put forth to the Relator. The Relator objected to that proposed resolution. The university went back and talked with the complainant, and a second informal resolution was put forth. Up until that time, if Relator had not accepted the informal resolution, Relator would have had the opportunity to have the full hearing. And so by doing that, the Relator waived those rights and therefore waived the subsequent internal appeal rights.
Right. My dates were off. So it was the August 5 was the final decision by the medical school that he was being discharged from the program. So after that point, Is he too late to go back and challenge administratively the informal proceeding? Is his only remedy the medical school decision? Or at that point in August 5, I'm trying to get a sense of whether, is it too late for him to go and challenge the university's original determination that he be put on probation?
And a follow-up question to that is, on August 5, he also withdrew from medical school. So I'm just wondering where that puts the med school once he's withdrawn. Can he take it back and say, I didn't mean it? Or how does that work?
So as to the first question, Relator would have had internal appeal rights had he not agreed to the informal resolution process. Because that informal resolution process, he waived those rights. The question is, can he wait until after the internal appeal period did expire for that OCS process to try to appeal it somehow and connect it to the Scholastic Standing Committee professionalism decision? The answer is no, from a policy standpoint, and there's no case law that would suggest that once that internal appeal process expired for the OCS process, that he would have had some chance to revive it through the Scholastic Standing process. As to the second question on what do we do with this withdrawal, that doesn't happen very often, so there's somewhat unique facts, but I think it informs. It's not, what we have here is not just a situation where someone delayed and was thinking about filing an internal appeal after the August 5th decision. It's not a situation where someone was confused about the process and made a mistake. So I think what the withdrawal does is it eliminates any confusion about intent, because that withdrawal letter specifically stated that, quote, I have decided to pursue an alternate path, and effective immediately, I'm withdrawing from the University of Minnesota Medical School. There's no reference whatsoever in there to bias or concern or procedural concern of appeal rights.
But to Judge Riley's question, let's assume this scenario. Assume he got the informal result, you're on probation. Then he has the medical school hearing, which is based in part on the findings of the university, I assume, the informal proceeding, not entirely de novo. And he hears, I gather orally, I'm not sure, the record's not clear on this to me anyway, whether he heard orally, maybe he got a phone call, maybe it was in person, or through the electronic communication, Zoom or whatever, however it was, the hearing occurred, that you're going to be dismissed completely from the program. And then that same day or the next day, he writes a letter saying, okay, I withdraw from the medical school, I assume before there's ever any findings put in writing, so that he can hopefully somehow use the probation as the ultimate determination and end any further process about his dismissal. So assume those are the circumstances. And then he writes this letter saying he's withdrawing. At that point, is his withdrawal letter a bar to his challenging the on appeal administratively the medical school's determination that he's being discharged?
I think the withdrawal serves as effectively a waiver of appeal rights at that point in time, but on the facts of this case, at no time after that withdrawal was submitted to the university did Relator try to revoke it or try to otherwise pursue internal appeals. And the benefit to the Relator, there was a benefit in terms of having a transcript mark with a withdrawal versus some other kind of mark on it. That was a choice that the Relator made instead of trying to appeal this internally.
Let me add to the facts of my hypothetical. Well, not hypothetical. These are the facts of the case. So he writes his letter to withdraw. Then he gets this written exposition that you're out. and he gets the reasons for it. At that point, does the fact that he wrote a withdrawal or letter prevent him from appealing the subsequent determination of his removal? Could he have, is there anything in the, that would have stopped, when we, as I look at whether or not he exhausted his administrative remedies, could he have in fact pursued administrative remedies at that moment, notwithstanding his letter withdrawing?
Well, if the question is what university policy have allowed it, I think that, you know, it's unusual for those facts to occur so quickly, for someone to withdraw 3 hours after someone informs them of the decision of the hearing panel. But the facts of this case are that the relator didn't even try to do that. So we don't know. And I think it still goes back to failure to exhaust, because had he tried to do that, then we would understand whether there was, the university made the wrong decision on whether to allow that internal appeal to go forward or not. And those facts just were not presented to the university, because Relator never had that communication. And again, the communication itself, the withdrawal communication itself, was unequivocal in terms of withdrawing from the university without reference to appeal or concerns, frankly, about the underlying process. Those were not referenced. It was just going in a different direction. And of course, students are allowed to go into different directions. You know, first year law students drop out and go in a different direction. People do this all the time. So, you know, that was a decision. The consequence of that was that this court, you know, doesn't have the opportunity to review the merits of the case.
Help me to understand. Help me to interpret what was happening in this email exchange and what was being said. So he writes an email saying, look, I'm just paraphrasing here without taking time to read it again, but I've withdrawn. What happens now? And he gets a communication back that the withdrawal, because of the timing of it, will stand or something like that, as opposed to findings of dismissal. What was being communicated there? Help me to interpret what you think he was saying and what the university was saying in response. Or Dr. Kim, I think. I'm not sure who the writer was.
The record isn't particularly clear on that point, Your Honor. You know, when we compile the record, we try to put together the materials that the panel would have made as part of its decision-making process. In terms of whether a relator asked questions in that three-hour period of time as to what was going to happen, do I have some options, are there benefits of doing this, it's not clear from the record. After the withdrawal was submitted, the university still went ahead as per its procedures and issued its written decision of the 7-0 unanimous decision of the Scholastic Standing Committee from August 5th. Obviously, it takes a little time to write up the opinion. I think that came out on August 12th, I want to say, August 13th, I think. And in that letter, there's a reference. You can tell at the bottom of the page that there would have been a place there that would have said, here are your appeal rights. But because the student had already withdrawn, there was a reference, well, here's the situation now. It's going to be, we talked about it, it's going to be a withdrawal on your transcript, but it's still going to be a university education record, so we're going to have that record. We're not going to throw away, in other words, the decision of the Scholastic Standing Committee. It just changes how it's noted on.
That was my question. I mean, it looked like, when I look at the August 6th email, it was from Robin Michaels, it feels like sort of promise. We decided that your withdrawal came first, and will hold as is. And I mean, first, I suppose, first before these findings are ultimately written, I think a week later, and will hold as is. I have a hard time figuring out what that meant. If I was in the relator's shoes, I might think what it means is, all right, you've withdrawn before we've presented anything. We're going to leave your withdrawal. That's going to be sort of the final thing, because it happened so quickly before we got to do our further report on our conclusions. And so that's going to be the thing in your record, the withdrawal, not the dismissal. Is that the way you interpret it? Or am I totally out in left field?
I can't speak to exactly what was going on behind the scenes, Your Honor, just what is in the record, but I can say that I read it slightly differently. I think it's just a clarification point, frankly, in terms of what's going to appear on the student's transcript. I did want to address, and I'm glad to answer any questions because my time is short, but I did want to address a little bit briefly on this timetable on this issue. The gist of the argument, I think, in the appellate brief is I was surprised. I was sandbagged by the university. I think if you look at the record, the addendum at page 3, this is Relator's own addendum, by June 15th, which is 3 weeks before Relator accepts the informal resolution on July 8th, 3 weeks prior to that time, that's when Relator's already discussing looking at an informal resolution for probation, but still discussing with his advocate, quote, the medical school dismissing me as a concern. So 3 weeks prior to entering into that, the Relator was thinking about the consequence. On June 23rd, the associate dean informs Relator that the role of the SSC is different than the OSCs. And then after that, and well before the August 5th hearing, there are a number of, we reference these in our brief, there are a number of citations in there before August 5th that clearly show that Relator was well aware of the consequences of that hearing and did not raise bias, did not raise really almost any of these arguments that are being raised on appeal before that hearing and had an opportunity to do so, and including an opportunity to challenge the bias of that panel and did not do so. And that's my time.
Thank you. Counsel for Relator, 5 minutes you have for rebuttal.
On the record on page 50, it's resolving alleged student conduct code violations, which indicates specifically that it encourages informal resolutions of alleged violations. And then on 74, it indicates that the party's right to withdraw from the formal resolution process and resume the grievance process with respect to the formal complaint. In this case, the complaint essentially withdrew in front of the medical school board while the agreement was already made. And so that didn't happen correctly. And basically, he walked into an ambush because 3 weeks prior, he acknowledged the dismissal, but then engaged in an informal resolution. And then afterwards, he's reminded that it's still on the table. So imagine you're getting evaluated for your conduct and you make an agreement on how to proceed. All the faculty indicates, yeah, we can work with you. We can do these classes. They even outline additional medical school classes that engage in rehabilitation. And then you engage in that informal resolution and you walk in front of this board. And then the complainant completely backs out of all the statements, indicates that the informal resolution was coercive and biased and that they felt.
But Mr. Robbins, the email that Mr. Herber referenced, the June 23rd email, it says the role of the SSC is separate from what's described above, which is the OCS. They do not approve, this being SSC, of any plans between accuser and accused, but rather separately address the issue of professional misconduct and breach of student code of conduct. And the SSC will convene a dismissal hearing where the committee will be given the complaint. And if there is an agreed upon plan between accuser and accused, I would think that would be seen as a positive step. But once again, it was really clear that the SSC was not bound by an agreement. At least that's my reading of the email. Which your client had well in advance of the July informal resolution.
Prior to the informal resolution, you're looking at all of the possible consequences. Engaging in a formal resolution and consulting with everyone, yes, this is a good way to resolve this. This is a positive step in the right direction. Reading and talking about the policies with the advocate, and they specifically indicate that to the extent any provision of this policy conflicts with the Board of Regents policy, the sexual harassment, sexual assault, stalking, relationship violence, the board's policy controls to the extent that any provision of this policy conflicts with any other university policy, this policy controls. And that's found on the records.
But why does that matter with regard to what the consequence is of violating the university's policy on the one hand and violating a different policy by the medical school on the other?
It matters because he didn't actually receive notice from the medical school until after the informal resolution process was engaged. And the medical school had the ability to investigate and pursue disciplinary actions independently, but then gave it to the university, allowed them to do what they want. And then when they didn't like the result and the complainant decided to not engage in the formal resolution and agree with the process, then they decided to implement their own remedy.
Except, Mr. Robbins, the email is from Robin Michaels, who is with the University of Minnesota Medical School Duluth. And she's really clear that there are two processes, one for the university and one for the medical school. And the medical school looks at issues of professional misconduct, and that there's a dismissal hearing that will happen after the university makes its findings and resolution.
But the nature of the agreement indicates an informal resolution, and the policies all describe how that is the way to resolve this, and it's encouraged, and the policy drives that, but then the medical school doesn't follow it.
Well, wait a second. It's how the university resolves its issues, but the email suggests that the medical school can independently resolve the issues differently. I mean, let me throw out an analogy, and you tell me if you think this is an inaccurate one, but in a matter of any individual's misconduct, let's assume that the government pursues civil remedies for misconduct and criminal remedies for misconduct. But in the civil case, which goes first, the parties agree to settle. But yet in the criminal case, of course, you can still pursue a criminal matter even if the case is settled and the individual agrees to pay a fine. But the criminal trial might go forward and the criminal trial might result in a greater fine. So I think that's the case as a matter of how the distinction between different tribunals work in the civil versus criminal setting. Is that not a fair analogy to what's happening here?
I would present that it's not, because the medical school falls under the university as an umbrella of policies and must follow their guidelines and overarching controlling policies, and they must tailor their own policies to fit within those requirements.
Why? So you're saying the medical school is not allowed to be more strict either in its policies or in its remedy than the university?
I'm not saying they're not allowed to. I'm saying is that they have to do it in accordance with the university's policies, and they did not.
Well, thank you for your brief, and thank you for both of you for your briefing and for your oral argument on this matter. The time is allotted for oral argument is ended, and the briefing is submitted. The case is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
With that, the panel will be in recess until our next case.